Welcome. Thank you for joining us this morning. We have a very distinguished panel. We actually have had a couple people, and I don't know if you've gotten far into the agenda and or the biographies, but we've had a couple people who backed out, so I just want to let you know that. And I'm going to let everyone introduce themselves and take maybe 3 to 5 minutes to talk a little bit about their role in reporting, working with environmental issues. And we heard earlier today a little bit, the first panel, they were talking about journalists are storytellers, and Native people traditionally have been known as storytellers. We like to tell our stories, and even now when we go to community events and some of our elders will stand up and tell some of the most incredible, beautiful stories of tradition. But as journalists, I think our role is to tell the story from our narrative, the Native narrative. And so I think that's very important. Most people think environmental issues is something that happened recently, and I have several slides or pictures that were of Standing Rock, and people who may not have known Native people existed all of a sudden said, wait, there are Native people still left here on this continent. And I said it kind of with a half smile on my face, but it's our reality. Sometimes we have to even deal with our very existence as Native people, because we have been known as the invisible people, the invisible minority. Our population base is very small. We may not necessarily fit the look of the stereotypical Native person with the braids or the ponytail, and a lot of it is how we've been brought up and who we are and how we embrace our culture. But I'm happy to be here today because, like I say, I think it's very important for us to tell our part. And I'm going to say something about Standing Rock. Last week I was in Chicago, and I was able to interview Tommy Orange. And Tommy Orange, I don't know, who knows who Tommy Orange is? Anyone know who he is? Got one person in the room. Tommy Orange is a young Native writer who his book is up for the National Book Review. It's called There, There. It's been on, I think it was spent 10 or 11 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It tells a story, very gripping story, about urban Indians as it relates to Oakland, California. And Tommy Orange said about Standing Rock last week that what he really liked about Standing Rock was it was regular people in street clothes standing up for themselves. And he did not use the word Native, because there were plenty of Native people there, obviously, but we had allies as well. But regular people in street clothes who stood up for themselves. So with that, I'm going to start by introducing Teresa. And Teresa, could you identify yourself and then talk about your role in environmental issues as it relates to Native people?
Hi, I'm Teresa Brain. Can everyone hear me? Yeah, no, they're not miking us unless we, so I'll talk.
They're strictly for recording purposes.
Right, so I'll scream into this microphone, and if you can't hear me, I can project more. So basically, my intro to Native American issues was when I got hired to be the environment editor at Indian Country Today, Indian Country Media Network, in 2011, and that was a whole eye-opening experience of a different way to see things. Before that, I've written for publications ranging from People Magazine, New York Daily News, World Health Organization, Women's E-News, so I've done a lot of work about women's issues, and I spent 7 years in Mexico reporting from there, and so that intersected with a lot of Native issues. And as the environment editor, I have covered a lot of things related to the ways in which industrial development comes at the price of indigenous and people of color's well-being, and the insidious ways in which the doctrine of discovery filters through to the contemporary treatment of indigenous peoples. And also, I seek out stories that highlight intersections between traditional indigenous knowledge and science, because there's a lot going on in that area, and the two can inform each other. I feel that there's no such thing as invisible people. There are people who don't see. So we have to bring these stories out. and get them seen and educate the people who aren't seeing as different ways of seeing.
Do we just start?
Okay. Hi, I'm Mark Trahant, and I have a couple of jobs, but one of them is editor of Indian Country Today, which is a digital news site. It used to be a newspaper. I'm also the producer of a TV show called Wasaha, and it's on First Nations Experience, which is a PBS sub-channel network in San Bernardino, California. And I'm from I'm a Shoshone Bannock tribal member from Fort Hall, Idaho, and I've been writing about indigenous issues for almost 40 years. And with the environment, there are a couple of themes that come up a lot. One is reporters tend to see things in the now, and they grab a story and think it's brand new and get really excited about it without looking through and finding the roots of the story. And virtually every story that involves indigenous people has roots that go deep. It's always worth pulling on those and seeing where they go. You can pick the story, and it'll do that. The other thing that happens with most environmental reporting about Native Americans is everybody does the same damn story. So somebody finds about how climate change is affecting a village in Alaska, and everybody goes to the same village. And that's good for that village, but there are other stories out there that are equally worth telling. Climate change is a significant, huge issue across the board, and there are multiple Native communities dealing with it in really complicated, sophisticated ways, much of it about resilience as well as total change. I can think of at least four major tribal communities that are going to have to relocate in the next decade or so. And they're already have planning going away, what that entails, how they're going to do it. And those are the kind of stories that also need to be told. The other thing I would encourage you to think about as environmental reporting is to think about the nature of government. We grow up learning about city, county, state, and never quite figure out how tribes figure into that. But tribes are actually governments that are in the Constitution that have a long history and going to have, in fact, I like to say that if you think about Shoshones, for example, we have a 10,000-year history in the region we're in, and that predates the United States, and I know that at some point it might postdate the United States, that history goes on in both directions forever. I also think in terms of the environment and climate change, one of the things to me that's most exciting from that perspective is that my folks once hunted mastodon, and you think about that was a pretty big climate shift, and somehow people figured it out. And so if you talk about that historical knowledge, whether it's encoded into DNA or something that's shared with stories, either way, it becomes really significant when a much larger society has to figure out how to make it through another environmental shift of that magnitude. And that's not just true of Shoshones. You think of the Pueblos that went through an entire shift in terms of where they were located because of changes in the climate. I think probably leave it at that.
Before I go on to Trina, I want to say about Mark. He and I was getting my microphone adjusted when I didn't really get to introduce him, but he is the reporter or the journalist who, when George W. Bush came to a conference, and he asked the president to define sovereignty. And it's, if you ever get a chance, Google, YouTube, Mark Trahant, sovereignty, he'll come up. So it's interesting. Trina?
Hi, my name's Trina. I am a Flint area resident. I have a lot of water privilege. I get to go home and wash my hands and take a shower. So I want you guys to all understand that I'm on the front lines every single day, but I'm also here to represent the frontliners. Unfortunately, our lawyer couldn't be here, but I want you all to understand that the future of news is citizen journalism. Why we got the story of Standing Rock out was because of citizens taking the initiative to put out the story raw. There was no filter. There was no editing. There was no pretense. So if you want the real story, I urge you all to seek out the citizens that are on the front lines. And every Indigenous person is a frontline warrior. And that includes our cousins south of the border. Right now in Flint, there's 300 Natives that aren't being represented, and our brothers and sisters from south of the border, our cousins, are not being represented fairly either. So please remember those people when you go and tell your stories.
We talked a little bit about Standing Rock, and I really don't want to concentrate on it during this whole panel discussion, but my first question to the panelists does relate to Standing Rock, and I'd like to ask Teresa, what are the lessons of Standing Rock for Indian Country?
Well, one thing that I noticed while covering it, I was guiding the coverage from New York City and guiding reporters on the ground and editing, overseeing it from that, and the worldwide scope. You know, we talked about Indigenous people feeling invisible. They found out that they're not alone, and there was and there still is so much mainstream support and heightened awareness, not only of Native issues, but also of the fact that what happens to Native peoples happens to everyone. So I think that was a really good major takeaway.
And you were editor at Indian Country Today of the environmental side?
Yeah, I was the environment and the Canada editor. And
During Standing Rock?
During Standing Rock, yeah. And, you know, we were up like half the night, my colleagues and I who were monitoring, you know, just watching the live feeds and everything. And then we had people on the ground as well. And so we were communicating with them constantly. And so it was like covering a war from my living room. So, you know, it was completely horrifying to see all these things being done to U.S. citizens, like in the Midwest, and in the name of corporate profit, basically. So it really made a mark, even if you weren't out there.
As it relates to journalism, you being an editor, I know at Native News Online, I was getting a lot of press releases from the state of North Dakota, and maybe even some of the county officials. What would you say was different from what the press releases were telling us as reporters and what the people on the ground were telling us?
Yeah, well, you would get these press releases from Morton County, and they would be saying, you know, these people were doing all these things, and we arrested all these people. And the people on the ground were saying, you know, we were being attacked. And, you know, you had video of people, like a journalist, being hit by one of those rubber bullets or something, and she fell on the ground. And the cops are just like, no, that didn't happen, or denying it, or saying that they did something that was at fault, that made them at fault. That woman, Sophie, who had part of her arm blown off, that was, you know, horrible. And I don't know if there's been any accountability related to that.
And Mark, what do you think the lessons from Standing Rock would be for Indian Country?
Well, first, I want to give a shout out to Indian Country Today, and it's important to note that there are two publications of the same name.
Yeah.
Indian Country Today Media Network went dark last September, and then the publication I work for, Indian Country Today, basically took over the assets and started from scratch. So they're really two different operations. That said, the Indian Country Today Media Network did a really fantastic job with Standing Rock. It was probably their finest moment as an institution. And did it with good, solid reporting on the ground, lots of things going on, lots of attention to big stories, willing to challenge conventional wisdom when it needed to be done, and doing it in real time. I mean, it really published a lot in fast getting it out there. I was at the time a blogger, and so the stuff I was writing was going. I have an interesting philosophy that actually I've carried through to my new job, and that is I don't believe you should ever charge for writing. And so all of the stuff I was doing was distributed for free, and a lot of publications were using it, from including Levi's.
Certainly.
From that era. To me, one of the most important things of the story is that it's part of a longer story, and it's just a single chapter. In fact, many of the elements that were so pronounced at Standing Rock, you could also say about Alcatraz. In fact, it's funny because the year after Alcatraz, across the country, Native Americans were having meetings about what does Alcatraz mean? What do we do with this story? How do we take it to the next level? And actually, a lot of things came out of that. A similar story that happened not long before Standing Rock was Idle No More. And Idle No More swept across Canada in ways that changed the conversation forever. And this continuing story and this push and pull is kind of one thing that came out of it. In a real practical form, one of the things I cover is politics. And this year, there are more than 100 Native Americans running for state legislatures, 10 for Congress, and 12 for state offices such as governor or lieutenant governor in a state. And to a person, almost everyone says, Standing Rock changed the equation, and that's one of the reasons why I'm running. Folks that thought they might be running in 10 years decided, no, right now I'm running. And it changed people's thinking in really dramatic ways. In terms of the ongoing conversation, I think there's some real sophisticated things going below the radar that will still be coming out. For example, there's been an awful lot of reporting about disinvestment by banks and what that means. But what there hasn't been a lot of reporting on is the actual boardroom conversations where banks are talking about investors are talking about new standards for investment and how you account for that. For example, one of the things that has been pressing and has really hit energy transfer partners, is the idea of you've got to account for civil disobedience in your income statements. If you don't, you're basically misleading investors. And the cost of Standing Rock was so great that any company that pretends that it didn't have costs is basically telling investors a lie. And so that's the kind of thing that's going on behind the scenes that remains a really relevant story. And it's already starting to factor in other pipeline disputes and other ongoing disputes. Probably the biggest one now would be, well, there are several that are extraordinary, but one that involves a lot of complexity is in Canada. And you're seeing that unfold where the government of Canada has basically said, as a national interest, we're going to do this. We're going to consult with tribes, but we've already decided to do this, which is kind of defeating the purpose of consultation, which is not unlike what happened at Standing Rock. I think one other thing that's not directly related to Standing Rock, but it's worth noting, is another area that's kind of changed is international organizations are rethinking how they include Native discourse. And in a little bit, it started with the UN Declaration of Indigenous Rights, but it's much more sophisticated now. And really where you're seeing it is agencies you've probably not heard of. One international body, for example, is the Arctic Council. The Arctic Council includes Indigenous knowledge as a governing parameter. And it's something that they have permanent members, they talk about on a regular basis, and they include that in their logic when they make decisions about what we're going to be doing in the Arctic. So that's something that's come out of this whole discourse that I think is really healthy and has an opportunity for substantial change.
Thank you. Now, people who went to Standing Rock became known as water protectors. And Trina, I understand you were at Standing Rock. You are a water protector?
I am a water protector. I actually was a supply runner. I ran supplies out, I believe, 4, maybe 5 times. Hard to keep them straight. The city of Flint actually stepped up a lot. So
Flint helped out people in Standing Rock?
Flint helped out a lot. They heard about it. We had just started finding out what was happening here.
Here in Flint, yes.
Here in Flint. And they understood how important water was and how much poisoning of that water supply would affect the entire country. So they stepped up and donated a lot of time and money to get out there. There were several residents from Flint who went out there.
In total, how many days do you think you spent out at Sandy Run?
Probably 2 weeks total.
2 weeks. And what did you, since we have a room full of journalists, what did you feel the reporting of Standing Rock in the mainstream media was? You think it was effective? Was it on course, right, on target? Or
the coverage of Standing Rock from the mainstream media was abysmal. CNN, NBC, they all sent somebody in. They helicoptered in for a few days. They got stories, but they also were very contrived. They set up their shots ahead of time. They practiced their lines. They made sure that they put out their narrative. I don't see how they even thought they got the story straight.
Thank you. I will remind the audience that we will open this up for questions here about quarter to two.
Is there a way to turn this off? It's very distracting.
Is it distracting?
Very distracting. Is it
possible? I'm pretty good with computers, but I'm not sure about theirs.
It's just, flickering every 2 seconds. They
got just about everything wrong.
Yeah.
They were still listening to Morton County. They were still willing to put out Morton County's press releases and try to be fair and balanced when those were all lies. Everything that Morton County put out was propaganda. And the mainstream media bought it because they were, to us, it seemed like they were reporting from news releases without being on the ground, or if they were on the ground, were trying to be too fair and balanced. So they weren't quite getting that this was an orchestrated attack by the oil company, who was paying Morton County's wages in order to attack water protectors.
I want to move to a subject of when many times you feel the resistance from tribes across the country. They will say, this property is sacred, therefore don't mess with it. I guess I would like to ask the panelists the question, describe what's meant by sacredness when among Native people.
Yeah, my understanding is basically that if we take care of the land, it takes care of us. And what I have seen as I covered these issues was that the sort of Western/European mindset confuses mastery with stewardship. It's like, oh, we're given this and we can do whatever we want with it because it's ours. It was given to us, made for us. Whereas the sacred nature is to treat everything with respect and to understand that if we trash it, then we're going to destroy our own lives. And to love it and practice gratitude. And I'm not Native, so I, but I do study a lot of different spirituality issues and practice meditation and all that. And you, the more you do it, the more you come to that conclusion. So that's how it resonates with me from what I've been working on.
Okay, thank you. Mark, can you weigh in on that?
My favorite poem is two lines, and it's, we worship the salmon because we eat the salmon. I think that kind of does it. The connectedness to where food comes from, where life comes from, how it relates to, again, place or places. A lot of tribes like mine wander. That fits into our worldview, and it's one reason why. I mean, it was interesting. I was in Dominica, and a friend of mine ended up in the hospital. And just before she went into surgery, the doctor told her, water is life. And Standing Rock.
I love it.
Yeah.
Trina, what does sacredness mean to you as it relates to land, space, and the environment?
When you talk about the sacredness of the land or the space, to me, you're talking about where we pray, where our children are born, where our ancestors are buried. Those things are more important. Yes, we have a stewardship. Yes, we have a responsibility. But in today's colonized society, we've had almost all of that taken away. So the last vestiges of our sacred spots are those places. The places where we bury our placentas for our children to know where they're connected. And to me, that is the last of our humanity. So for me, that's what the sacredness is.
Okay. A friend of mine, Colleen Sisk, who is a chief out in California, she said that people should not get afraid of that word sacredness, that when Native people, American Indians, speak about the sacred, we're not trying to take you back to the Stone Age. And I thought that was pretty profound. I actually thought about that on the way over here from Grand Rapids. I live in Grand Rapids, and many times I think that Native people are misinterpreted because they don't always understand why we think the way we do. So I just want to let you know that when we talk about the environment and sacredness, sacred sites, we're not trying to go back to Stone Age. We're just really trying to protect our culture. So, panelists, I'm going to start with you, Trina, this time. What is... Come in? Okay. Trina, could you tell me what is the single biggest challenge facing Indian country today when it relates to the environment?
I think the biggest challenge that faces Indian country is that we are all on the front lines. We know what our purpose is. Our purpose is to protect the earth. So we're being assaulted every minute of every day by this society who thinks that they have a right. Their manifest destiny is to control this land and to control all the people and animals in it. So we can't give up for one single minute, and we are exhausted.
Mark, single biggest challenge facing Indian country?
Well, the impact of climate change, I think, is going to be the single biggest challenge. And how communities deal with it is dramatic. In December, I did a film on Dominica. And the folks there, the Kalinago, they used to be called the Caribs, first tribe to meet Columbus. And... I mentioned people do the same stories over and over. Everybody that's been on islands writing about Hurricane Maria has gone to Puerto Rico, and it's an important story to tell. But Dominica is the first island that got hit. And when you start talking about having to reclassify hurricanes from 5 to 6 because 5 doesn't convey the damage anymore that's being done, and the very tip of the island is the Kalinago territory, and they got hit very first of that storm. And when you're dealing with a community that's in poverty anyway, to have it completely flattened is pretty extraordinary. But here's the cool thing. So they've been arguing with the government for about a decade about whether or not it's more cost-effective to build Kalinago-style homes or just to build the homes that the government wants done by ordinary contractors. And Kalinago homes cost more. They have very tall roofs. They use a wood that you have to get in a particular moon phase. And they talk about the importance of harvesting it only at that time. And the Kalinago homes came through the storm without any problem.
Wow. That's fantastic. Teresa.
Well... The reason that tribes are on the front lines is, like a lot of poorer communities, they've been relegated to the vulnerable areas. One example I can think of offhand is that the Shinnecock Nation in Southampton on Long Island, they were saying, you know, before Europeans came, they used to have a couple of different places they lived because they knew where the floodplains were and where they were going to be pushed out of by the change in the seasons. So they had different places that they went, and then they were pushed and located to the one area, which is right near the coast. And so when big storms come, they get hit harder. And so a lot of tribes around the world deal with that. And it's like Mark was saying, everyone does the same story. Everyone and their mother, including the old Indian country, wrote about Kivalina up in Alaska, which is slowly being eroded, and they're trying to relocate. There are a lot of places like that, and some of them inland as well, because, you know, now, like with Hurricanes Irene and other places, the rivers flood. And I recently was hearing that the classification of hurricanes only talks about the wind, and the real story nowadays is the water, and that can rise anywhere. It's not just the coasts.
Thank you. Hey, Mark, earlier in your introductory remarks, you mentioned there may be four native communities are in danger. Could you tell us what those are?
Oh, well, Kivalina's one. There's several in Alaska, and I mean, part of it is, so you have a community that's based on subsistence, and the economy is built around following different animals. And for one community, Wales, Alaska, the walruses are coming later because the water is warmer. And so building their entire economy around how that pattern fits in, because the walrus comes first and they follow with salmon. And if that's out of order, suddenly, basically, the economy is trashed. And that would be an example of one. One very large community is Tohola, Washington, which is on the coast about 2 hours west of Seattle. That's on a river. It's on the mouth of the Tohola River, but it's also on the coast. They're now getting storm surges that are starting to impact. There's a community in Louisiana that's having to move. The Kalinago are talking about whether or not they're parts of the island they should be able to rebuild or whether they have to move. So it's becoming a conversation in many more communities. I think Alaska is probably at the top of the list in terms of impact and how it's going to affect communities quicker than anywhere else.
Using a grading scale with A being excellent and F meaning failure, what grade would you give the Trump administration so far on its handling of environmental sovereignty issues? Teresa.
Well, at the old ICT, we graded presidents and rated them according to how well they treated sovereignty. The low bar was Andrew Jackson, who started the Trail of Tears. And I would be interested to know how Trump stacks up against him. He's running roughshod over those rights the way he is over everything else. I'd give him, I guess, at least a D.
Mark?
I don't know about grades. I mean, on one hand, there's a positive in the sense that they're so interested in energy development that they're giving tribes some authority to do some things that tribes might not have been able to do a while ago. But it's because they want the coal. Whether or not that plays into environmental concerns, we'll see. I mean, it really is an open book. They're certainly not putting any money into environmental issues that need to be paid attention to. The idea of the climate change in their own report is devastating in terms of how fast, how much the temperature is going to increase because of policies. If you have to put a grade on it right now, it's not very good because they're just one of the crazy stories of this administration is how few jobs they've filled. They haven't even figured who they want to run the thing. And that has implications across the board because you have folks who are still within the existing bureaucracy making some pretty substantial decisions because there's no one been appointed to do it. This administration has challenges that they haven't addressed that are probably greater in scope than any generation in history, and that's because things are moving up faster. And so the types of things they're going to have to deal with on a regular basis are going to become more significant. The thing to me about climate change is you really only have two choices. It's adaptation or mitigation. And how much do you want to spend on one? Is it going to impact how much you spend on the other? And if you pretend it doesn't exist, you're going to be spending on mitigation. That's the only alternative. Or adaptation, rather.
Trina?
I'm going to tell you it's a big fat F. They are spearheading the effort to criminalize the protesting of what we're doing on the front lines. They have ignored the science. I don't know how science could be controversial, but they've made it that way. And they're playing semantics about man-made versus natural. Who cares whether we did it or we didn't? It's happening, and they're refusing to see it. They're idea of granting us sovereignty, like Mark was saying, is not in order to give us our own voice. It's so that people can come in and extract even more from an indigenous community. The Bears Ears, where they're allowing our sacred sites that we fought really hard for, that we petitioned, we played the game their way. They came into our land and imposed rules. Here we are trying to play by those rules, and they're yanking the rug out from under us. So for me, the Trump administration has failed on every single front you could fail on.
Thank you. What are the most effective ways for non-native journalists to cover environmental issues impacting Indian country? Teresa?
Well, as a non-native journalist, I can say I found an entry point, as it were, in and this has become like a passion of mine, is to look for the intersection of traditional knowledge with modern science, because 10,000 years of trial and error can't be wrong. Modern science traditionally doesn't see indigenous knowledge as science, but it actually is science. And increasingly, scientists from like NOAA and all kinds of research institutions are turning toward native peoples. And they're too have a lot to inform each other on, and they're complementary as opposed to being oppositional. I did one story about the Shinnecock Nation. They were part of a team practicing ocean conservation, and with scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they won this award, the Robert Benchley Award, which is, I'm told, the Oscars of ocean conservation awards. And it was weaving together tribal knowledge with science and recognizing the seafaring knowledge of all these indigenous people that existed long before European settlers came here. And they didn't have technology or anything. They were just able to read the environment. So it is important to look into our own hidden assumptions that we don't know we carry. There's like one example is Faith Spotted Owl during Standing Rock was talking about the state archaeologist coming through and saying, well, these piles of rocks aren't burial sites, because like he had an idea of what a graveyard would look like. And she was like, no, these are where we put people to give them back to the elements. So there was just a whole disconnect. They saw what they wanted to see. They had a specific idea of what it should look like, and it didn't look like that, so they decided it wasn't that thing. And that is, you know, we do that all the time without realizing it. And I would say start covering the disaster part of natural disasters, like the man-made phenomena they are. I was listening to 60 Minutes recently, and this one expert said, the disaster part is man-made, and 60 Minutes guy goes, that's a radical statement. And it's like, it's not a radical statement. It's a fact that with people in those vulnerable areas, and then it turns into a disaster for humans and their lives because they were put there, not always of their own volition. So it's important to understand that, like, if you have a natural disaster or an event that happens somewhere where there's no people, the same stuff is going to happen. Trees will fall down, you know, but it's not going to affect people. So you have to look at the man-made component. Yeah, there are just a lot of stories. If people want to read, send me their email, I can give examples. There's a great story by Terry Hansen in Pacific Standard magazine, the current issue, where she talks all about the danger of plunder. You know, like tribes hesitate to share their knowledge because then corporations come in and co-opt it and then market it and then don't give anything back to the people who actually discovered it in the first place. Yeah, and then there's quirky stories that connect indigenous people to the mainstream. Like this one guy, when they discovered the gravitational waves, this one guy from the Blackfeet Nation worked in that office, and he had his mother translate the press release into Blackfeet. And so they, you know, there was this whole indigenous angle to it that sort of we reported, but it was, you know, and it was like a sideline, but it was an interesting connection there. One of my things that and also find stories that connect to mainstream just to raise awareness. For instance, when Kellyanne Conway was going on about the fictional Bowling Green massacre, I was all, wait a minute, there was a massacre at Bowling Green in New York, what's now New York City, Bowling Green, and it was the Lenape being killed by the Dutch. And so I dug that up and published a story on that, and then that got picked up by Mike.com and The Root and a whole lot of other places. So that's another way to get visibility to Native issues. And that's about it.
Mark?
So last year, the Supreme Court ruled that Washington State has to remove culverts. Doesn't sound like a very big deal. Culverts. But if you know the history of that, it shows how a long arc story really is impactful. So I grew up, my tribe is a salmon tribe, and we grew up with salmon. And the way we would do it is we would chase them. It would be, in fact, the word is hunting, and we use spear poles and catch them. And when I was in my teens, I remember my dad getting arrested for doing it. And then the salmon started to go away, and there were fewer and fewer numbers. And then something extraordinary happened. The Supreme Court ruled in the Bolt decision that tribes had a right to half the fish. Fish in common was the phrase. And that changed one thing. It forced the state of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho and tribes to work together on natural resources and start to come up with management plans. And this sounds really boring, but it's an amazing story. Those management plans over the next 40 years have actually returned fish to the river. And they've done it in pretty remarkable ways. And I am convinced that salmon would have gone extinct had it not been for that court decision and how then the states and tribes started working together. So fast forward to last year, tribes said, you know, there's still more work to be doing. And one of the problems we have is that fish get to a culvert and a road and they can't go to spawning grounds. And it's Washington State said, yeah, we agree with you in principle, but it'll cost too much to replace every culvert in the state of Washington. And the tribe said, it's got to be done. And they even came up with a timetable to say, here's how you can do it over a period of time. And again, Washington State, including, this shows how a lot of Native issues are really bipartisan because it was mostly Democrats saying, we can't afford to do this. Gets to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court looked at the treaty. They looked at the tribe's case, and they said, you know what? This treaty says the tribes have a right to common, and if you're killing the salmon because they can't get through a culvert and you're doing the damage, you've got to fix this. And it was a case that everyone knew should not go to the court, that this could have been worked out in a room, basically. But they pressed it, and the tribes won. Now Washington State is beginning one of the most massive infrastructure programs in the country, completely under the radar, of replacing culverts across the state. And this is one where you're not going to see the results for at least 20 years, 30 years. But when your grandkids have salmon, this is where it's going to come from.
Thank you. And Mark mentioned something that I think is worth noting to journalists in the room, that most tribes around the United States, and there are 673 now, federally recognized tribes, have a Department of Natural Resources or an environmental department, and they may be called a little different. Not all tribes are alike, but I think that's very important to the journalists in the room that if you have an issue, do not be afraid to pick up the phone and call the tribe and ask the question. Because we have, we hire biologists, we hire educated people. These are not just people going out, spreading out tobacco, and nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying that they're not just doing the ceremonial things. These are educated people who, as Mark said, are working hand in hand many times with the state officials, if the state listens, but that's a whole different discussion. But Trina, before we open it up to the audience, please tell us how journalists, non-native journalists, can better cover environmental issues in Indian country.
To cover the environmental issues in Indian country, non-natives need to listen to the natives. That's the number one thing. Don't come in with your agenda that's going to fill whatever they're saying back in your newsrooms, whatever you need to publish. Our elders have a lot of stories. Our elders will tell you what it was like and why it's wrong. But they're not going to give you a 3-minute soundbite. You're going to have to sit. You're going to have to sit at their table. You're going to have to let grandma not only feed you, but dress you and try to marry you off. So you really just need to spend the time to try to understand why these things are important, because our worldview is very, very different. We are going to have things that are diametrically opposed to the way that you were taught in these schools that come from a colonial worldview. We understand that we're entering into a global age, but we are also so tied to the land that our stories exist from a long time ago. And you need to hear every single one of those stories. I know you guys don't have time. You guys got deadlines. You guys have print times that have to be out. But at the same time, you're not doing any of your subjects any good if you're only taking what you want out of it.
Thank you very much. And I am going to open it up to the audience now, questions. And I have been asked that members of the SEJ go first, and journalists. So if you have a blue tag on, feel free. Yes.
I was going to say the problem with the single story is a really big issue with minorities and demographics that are underrepresented. As far as all of you in the panel, this is an open-ended question. What are the salient single stories that are hurting the tribes? What are the main easily or sensationalized stories that are actually misrepresenting the tribe? I guess in the case of Standing Rock, if you want to start there.
Well, one I wrote about yesterday is right now the phrase tribalism is destructive has been
used. I like
used
that, too. That's good, Mark.
A lot. And to me, it has such different connotations as people with shared history, geography, culture. But yet, one of the doctrines that the Supreme Court has been pushing is that tribes are not governments but just communities of interest. And that kind of defies the history where, going back to a trilogy of cases involving the Cherokee Nation that basically codify the idea of governments. So that's a push and pull that is worth exploring. I think demographics are really huge, and it's going to be really interesting because the population of the United States is in a shrink mode, and Indian country is in a growth mode. And so those two things are on different tracks. It'll be really interesting to see how they shape out. I think the average age now of Native Americans, I shouldn't do this off the top of my head because I'll get it wrong, but it's a good 10 years below the general mm-hmm. population, and still has a higher birth rate and that sort of thing. So how that plays out, I think, will be really interesting.
Next question.
Lydia. I'm Melanie Kildar from KPX Public Radio in Seattle. I wanted to ask about this sort of general question of environmental sovereignty and the state of it, and the state of, I mean, what I've seen over the past few years in my area is what feels like importance of tribal treaty rights in big environmental fights. We saw those rights keeping the export terminal at Cherry Point from being built because the mummy brought that. The Gold decision, as you mentioned, was a big win. And I feel like that's very important. And most recently, the Trans Mountain Pipeline ruling up in Canada, it's very interesting to see that. And I'm wondering if you can speak specifically to Trans Mountain and where you see that going at this moment. Is there an elevated sense of tribal sovereignty and treaty rights, or is this really difficult in the Trump campaign?
Did everyone hear that question? Okay, good.
Oh, because we're supposed to repeat it, I think. For
yeah. That. I have no way to repeat that question. the importance of treaty rights, I guess.
Yes.
With summarizing it. Well, I think treaties have always been important. The thing that George Bolt did in his decision that has become kind of a canon is he said you have to interpret treaties based on how people at the time saw them. And that one idea is really powerful because it says if you're fishing in common, it means you really are fishing in common, that you get access to the fish. And that means you can't do things that are going to take away fish, which definitely in Cherry Point case is something that came up in the discourse. So Cherry Point, and it actually involves tribes on both sides because one of the tribes on the other end wanted to have shipments of coal go to Asia. But the Lummies successfully argued that the treaty, the right to fish in the Columbia area would be diminished in salmon all the way through if I'm mixing two terminals, but that you can't, because coal, the way coal is transported by train, there's a lot of dust involved, and it would get in the water, and it would degrade the quality of the salmon, and that was their argument, is that would take away a treaty right, which is, in U.S. Jurisprudence, a property right, and so they basically codified it in that way, and were successful in that. The flip side of that is, and the Crows would argue they had a treaty right, but there really is no treaty right to sell coal. But they would argue that the tribes in the Northwest pushed against them in their right to determine coal. It's funny because I was at a conference with the Crows just this week, and they were still arguing about this war on coal. And it's funny because you ask them, well, what about market forces? It's the market that's wiped out coal. Mm-hmm. And they really don't make that connection even now, and they still see the Northwest tribes as being on the other side of this issue.
But what about Trans Mountain? I
don't know. I think it's not going to happen. But and that gets into issues within the bays and how it's interesting because it really right now you're seeing a lot of divide and conquer technique where you go to a small band and say sign it deal, and whether that's able to stick. The thing about governments, and whether it's Trudeau or Trump, is governments are not permanent. And one of the greatest nights of my life as a reporter was so Canada signed a constitution. I forget what year, maybe the late 70s. And maybe you probably don't know this story, but the way it worked is they had to get the different provinces to ratify their new constitution. And they were taking it back from Britain. It was called, what was the phrase? At any rate.
Evolution.
No, it was something else.
Repatriation.
It was kind of repatriation, yeah. And they let it go, and it got into this debate, and it finally had to go through the Manitoba legislature. And that night, I happened to be in Manitoba. Actually, it wasn't Manitoba. It was just about an hour north of here. There was a small reserve called Thunder Bay, I think. No, anyways, a small reserve about an hour north of here. And a senator by the name of Elijah Harper had stood up in the Manitoba legislature, and they put it on the unanimous consent calendar because they thought everyone wanted Canada's constitution to come home. And he stood up in the Senate and lifted a feather in the air and voted no. And it killed the Canadian constitution. And that night he flew to Detroit and then flew up to this, or drove up to this reserve for a speech. And when he walked in this place, it was like a conquering hero. The place just erupted with this amazing, and he talked about how he did it and why he did it. But that government thought, and it was his actually Pierre Elliott, so it was his father, thought that it was a done deal, but that those voices of dissent kept in there and kept at it, and eventually were successful. The other favorite story I have about this is in 1906, the Forest Service took probably the most sacred place to the Taos Pueblo and moved it into the U.S. Forest Service. And from 1906 through 1975, the tribe just kept saying, we're going to get this back. It's just a question of when, not if. And they kept pressing, because religious leaders all made the case. And there was a Secretary of Agriculture who eventually got elected to the Senate by the name of Clifford Anderson. And he made it his mission to make sure the Pueblo never got this land back. And every time it would come up in Congress, he would basically use he had been the committee chairman, but then he picked somebody else to do it and worked with that person to make sure this bill would always come up. Well, in 1975, the tribe made the case again. Richard Nixon had just been elected, and he was looking for an issue that nobody cared about. And they met with John Ehrlichman, and Ehrlichman looked at the paperwork and said, you know, the tribe is right. This land was stolen. This really is their lake. And Ehrlichman, I interviewed him later about it. He told me that they wanted to stick it to Democrats, and they thought this was a great way to do it. So in 1975, the Nixon administration returned Blue Lake to the Pueblo. And what's extraordinary is the tribe knew that whole time that there will be governments come and go, but they're going to get this back. It was just a question of when. Now one of the coolest things is if you go to Pueblo, and every year they have a celebration of this event, if you go to Taos during that celebration and go into a grade school, all the grade school kids tell the story of how they got Taos Blue Lake back. And it's part of their narrative, their mythology now, about how Longview always wins. And I think that's something to think about in terms of these stories.
You, young man. Do you want to fill that one?
Yeah. The first thing you need to understand is that our sovereignty predates the United States. It predates Canada. We are nations within nations. We are fully functioning nations on our own. We don't need the United States. They need us. As far as how you would write about it, I think you need to go back to the treaties, because the United States Supreme law of the land are the treaties. So if they're not honoring them, they're not honoring their own laws.
I think I would add that don't just rely on historic documents, which they are important. We all know that as reporters and journalists, that you have to have good sources that are historic in some cases, or documents. But don't be afraid, and I mentioned it before, about calling those tribal offices and asking to talk to the appropriate person. Similar to how every tribe basically has a DNR, they usually have a historic preservation department as well, and they may call it cultural department or whatever, but they will have, typically most tribes have elders, ceremonial people who would be very well versed if you want to really know the story behind that. And I'll just be blunt, sometimes the young elected tribal chairman may not even know some of those stories because they haven't been taught. But don't be afraid to talk to the cultural departments and get to the source, and don't be afraid, instead of just writing about, go get it, go get that story. So yes,
there's a great website I want to mention that tells you, you can put in your zip code and it'll tell you where you're from on an indigenous land and who's which tribes were there first, and it's a really cool site. And it's, pardon, I'll have to look it up. I don't remember, but yeah, it is. And it's cool because then you can acknowledge the people who are there.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Emily Gertz. I'm an independent journalist.
How do nominated reporters report differing opinions within tribal nations or even within the tribe itself? Do you want to feel that one, Teresa?
Yeah. So we didn't do a lot of intertribal things, but one thing that that resonates is there are two tribes. There are two tribes on one reservation. You know, they were just like all lumped together. One is okay with killing eagles, and the other, it's anathema to kill eagles. And so we would always kind of try to balance that out by just respecting each side and not – and I never wrote directly about – like, we didn't delve deeply into those differences. But basically just to acknowledge that – you know, because it's easy to lump all, quote, native peoples into one, and that was really a European construct. As Trina said, everyone's different, and there are separate nations. And so it just, you have to give equal weight in that type of scenario.
I'd like to add, this is where you build the relationships. I understand that it's hard to get to us. We're pushed out into the boonies on purpose. So this is where you... when I said go and let grandma feed you, this is where you build those relationships. Those relationships, you'll learn what their biases are, what their fight is with the family down the road. But what you see in Indian country is true democracy. So coming from a representative democracy, you guys are going to have to deconstruct and understand what true democracy is, that everybody's voice is just as valuable as anybody else's. So to tell the story, you do have to tell both sides. You do have to tell what each one is saying, but you have to understand that it is just one voice. We don't have very many authorities on anything.
I think the complexity is important, and some of the places you mentioned are actually the most complex, probably MHA. Right now, in fact, we have a story Monday. MHA has an election, it's election day. And MHA is an energy tribe, and probably primarily gas and oil, the whole Bakken oil development, also coal. And they have tremendous dissent within the tribe about what that means and who should decide and how much money should be reserved for other things. And their election next month is one pro-development candidate against another pro-development candidate.
Wow.
And I think that really shows the complexity of trying to deal with some of these issues. They also sent out a memo just this week after our reporter started calling, instructing all tribal employees to not talk about this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sir?
First, let me just follow up with Billy Frank, because I don't think there are some heroes that need to be mentioned in the context of how they're part of a national story that don't get told. And the world knows who Nelson Mandela is, but America doesn't know who Billy Frank was. And they really ought to be in that same sentence.
True, that's true.
My kids used to laugh because he'd walk in and, "God damn it, Mark!" And I said, "How can he be such a respected person when he talks like that?" He was a real character. Billy, his favorite story was that he was a getting arrested guy who became a policy guy. From the 1970s through the 1980s before Bolt, he probably was arrested 150 times for fishing and kept pressing and pressing. And that's the nature of dissent. And it's really important to know that a lot of these folks press the issue until they force a government to react. And that's the nature of what is supposed to happen. That's when the system is working. And Billy was one of those guys that kept pressing and pressing and getting arrested and arrested until finally he started getting appointed by the governor to state trustee for the schools or university system, human rights commission awards, all those sorts of things. So pay attention to who the heroes are, I guess, is the message there. The second point on where the next stories would be and how to kind of I would follow dissent. Again, in Alaska, you're seeing a lot of communities that are dealing with subsistence issues. Where it comes down to now is the reindeer caribou issue on where folks are going to be able to follow that and how those are going to be managed. And, I mean, if a community can't subsist in the way they did before, and it gets into things like, so if you harvest reindeer in some places in Alaska, you have to get the meat to Anchorage or Juneau for inspection before you can eat it. And the costs associated with that. And folks, we've been doing this a long time. We know what good meat is, and to being able to figure that out is one of the ones still to come. Anyone, they're interesting to know the difference between reindeer and caribou? Reindeer are domesticated. Same critters.
Sir. You. Yes.
Right.
Do you feel that there's any difference how they treat natives in the northern border compared to the southern border?
Do I repeat that question?
The differences between how natives are treated north of the border and south of the border is that we actually were able to sign treaties, whereas the Spanish came in and made them the lowest class of their society, so they don't have any rights. And we recognize that. We recognize that there's so much more. There's a lot of privilege in American Native society. We have the benefit of being our own governments. We have the benefit of those treaty rights. Whereas south of the border, we know that they're still outcast, that they're still being pushed. They are who's coming across our border right now. They are coming in their traditional trade routes. They are coming in their traditional migration routes. And yet this artificial border that's been imposed, it means the difference between prosperity and despair.
How about the tribes that are right on the border?
The tribes that straddle the border or sit right on that border face challenges that those of us way north don't see, because their families live on both sides. Their trade, their traditional food gathering, the way that they conduct their ceremonies belongs on both sides of that border. Whether it was, first of all, that's all Spanish territory, and they treated their people horribly to begin with. But when the United States came in and they start imposing new rules and giving rights to some and not to others, you know, the Chumash got pushed way south. And south of that border, they're having to hold together in ways that we take for granted up here. I'm a historian, so sorry, I'm going to...
Sir, way in the back. Mark, you want to fill that one?
Okay. I don't think I can repeat the question, but one of the ways that I think journalism education ought to start is everybody should think about epistemology. And that's one of those words we can use on a college campus that we'd get in trouble if we went outside and said it. Basically, that's how do you know what you know? How do you check that? What are the ways you do that? And there needs to be rigor in that respect. And I think journalism often... There's a phrase in journalism that I think is really dangerous, and that's the boilerplate, the paragraph that's been used in every story explaining what happened before. And often the boilerplate's wrong, and yet it's used over and over, and that's where you get into this rigor of looking back at the roots of the story. Did you say you're from Santa Fe? Did you say Santa Fe? Where did you say you're from?
Originally, I'm from Ethiopia, but I
But the role of history is essential. Oh, here on campus. Okay.
We've been told it's time for lunch. Thank you very much.
I just want to say, if you want to know what's happening in Indian Country, you need to follow Native News Online, Indian Country Today, Digital Smoke Signals, and Women's Indigenous Media.
Thank you. Thanks. I have cards if anyone is interested.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.